Ways and Means Public Safety Subcommittee for Monday, February 28th, 2005, and also open the hearing on House Bill 5057, which is the Oregon Department of State Police. And we are pleased to have the superintendent of the Oregon State Police with us this afternoon, along with the budget director for the organization. And let us now begin with the record showing that we are opening without a quorum, but we do expect to have a full complement of members before we end today. Good afternoon, Superintendent.
Good afternoon, Senator. For the record, my name is Ron Richter, Superintendent of the State Police, and I have been aware of some of the committee's prior experiences, and I have set out several dollar bills on my debit card so that I may keep up with the acronym penalties if I have to incur any. We are happy to be here and have the opportunity to talk about the Department of State Police, and most importantly, its men and women in the job that we are privileged to attempt to accomplish for the people of the state of Oregon. How we intend to proceed, at least in my opening remarks, is to talk about generally the department and its mission, its structure, some kind of high point budget issues that I'm sure the committee is going to want to talk about and will explore fully before these hearings are concluded. And then after I finish, we'll, with the committee's permission, get right into the division-by-division testimony by staff members other than myself.
Superintendent, may I ask you to pull that microphone closer to you?
Yes,
that,
ma'am.
That's fine, just like that. And if you'll just keep us on track with what pages you're referring to, that'll be
If I may, Madam Chair, I'd like to introduce or at least draw your attention to a few people that are with me here today, and also ask your indulgence as I occasionally try to keep my voice with the help of a little bit of water. I'm having some trouble. I mentioned Ken Weiss, my budget director, is seated to my right. Of course, you know Linda Gilbert, our DAS analyst. But seated immediately behind me is one of our telecommunicator 2 is the job classification, Ms. Peggy Eaton. Peggy Eaton works at the Southern Command Center in Medford, Central Point, rather. And as part of a little fundraiser we had going on inside the Department of State Police some months ago, there was a name drawn out of a hat. It happened to be Peggy Eaton's. And the prerogative of that, of the person having their name drawn, was that they could either come to Salem and follow me around and try to get some understanding for what I do for part of a day, or have me come out to the field and try to do their job for part of a day. And Ms. Eaton's job is highly technical. I did go to Central Point and spend a few hours in the dispatch center and quickly realized how much that job had changed since 30 years ago when I did that as starting out in my career with a pad of paper and a pencil. It's now very high tech, and so I'm happy to have Ms. Eaton here to get some understanding of what goes on in the legislative process. There are various other staff members also seated behind me, excuse me, some of whom will be testifying after I finish. There are two major issues in the state police budget, and if I may refer you to behind the tab that says Superintendent Summary, the page is entitled Oregon State Police Ways and Means Public Safety Subcommittee Budget Presentation. And I mentioned already that we're going to go through a few things here, and one of which, of course, will be our 10% reduction package. But going on to the next point, I think there are two major issues that are different in our budget for this time than have been in the past. And the first is the separation of three divisions that formerly or currently actually legally are still part of the state police but are being merged into the Office of Homeland Security at the direction of the governor's executive order.
I apologize.
The Office of Emergency Management, the State Fire Marshal Division, and the Criminal Justice Services Division will be part of the new Office of Homeland Security. And then secondly, is the fund shift from general fund or to lottery funds as the governor's recommended budget specifies that this revenue from line games would be the vehicle for funding the Patrol Services Division and part of the Fish and Wildlife Division. I think I'm going to make it through this. If not, Greg Williford is ready to go.
I'm going to ask the committee to be at ease just for a few minutes. And we're now back on the record.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, for the record, my name is Greg Williford. I am a Lieutenant Colonel with the Office of Superintendent within the Department of Oregon State Police, and certainly glad to help out here with the presentation from the Superintendent's office. As was mentioned, there are two primary differences in this proposed budget before you has to do with the separation of the various components that make up the new Oregon Department of Homeland Security from the Department of Oregon State Police. That was within the department, the Oregon Department of Emergency Management, State Fire Marshal Office in there, and then the components of the Department of State Police Office of Public Safety and Security will be operating underneath the contract service to that newly created office. The second one was, again, the shift of the general fund out of the patrol division to exclusively lottery funds, and then approximately $4 million or 18 FTE of fish and wildlife positions are also funded, proposed video lottery revenues. Essentially, the mission of your Department of State Police is to develop, promote, provide protection to the people and property and natural resources of the state, along with ensuring the state's safety and livability by serving, protecting, and educating its citizens and its visitors through leadership, action, coordination, cooperation with our public safety partners. It's important to recognize that your Department of State Police truly does function as an important component in a greater system. It provides many different services, but many which support the overall public safety system within the state of Oregon. You squeeze one portion of the department's services, such as forensics or ID services, and you're going to have an effect on the greater public safety system. Essentially, how we're structured and how we deliver our services, I can move to that which was in your tab there. And we have currently, below the Office of Superintendent, two bureaus, and they're commanded by a major in each of those.
Madam Chair, we also have another chart that we're going to have brought to you that will line up with what the Colonel's talking about.
Are we following the text that is on page 4, the description of the bureaus?
Page 2. Okay, the bureaus will be, the bureau commanders will be both coming up throughout the week to provide you the detail of specific division programs and structure of the bureau and the divisions. So I'm actually on page 2, which is just a overview of the department's overall structure.
All right. And we now have a quorum for the record.
The two bureaus, there is the Operations Bureau and a Support Services Bureau. Within the Operations Bureau, it has three divisions that report to the Bureau Commander. Those are your Uniform Patrol Services Division, troopers primarily working state and interstate highways, your Criminal Investigative Services Division, and the Fish and Wildlife Division. The Department's Public Information Officer also reports to the Operations Bureau Commander as far as our structure goes. We provide services through that Operations Bureau and our partners in public safety through three regional offices throughout the state and several field patrol offices that are located throughout the state as well to make up the operations framework for delivery of services. Turning to the Support Services Bureau, we have five divisions underneath that bureau that report to the Bureau Commander. Those divisions are the Forensic Services Division, the State Crime Lab System, the Office of State Medical Examiner, the Gaming Enforcement Division, which is the lottery, tribal gaming component, and boxing wrestling components, Information Management Division, and the Human Resource Services Division, which is the business office of the organization. The majority of the services provided from this bureau are provided to the public and our public safety partners through the offices located in Salem and the six forensics laboratories throughout the state. We went through, as requested by the co-chairs, to also look at our programs and to develop a prioritized list and a criteria for prioritization of all of our primary public safety programs, and we did that utilizing a system or framework that has five criteria elements in that.
We applied these principles, if you will, and I think you should have a chart. I apologize for the size of the font. But in a box at the bottom of the prioritized list, which should be the very last page of it.
Yeah, sure. Are you on the 10% list?
Yes.
Okay, so I think it's the last page in that packet, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct. Thank you. But it's a very difficult thing to prioritize services when in a scenario where everything you do is a priority. So we applied some principles to help us guide the establishment of these priorities. The first of those, these are lettered A through E in your chart. And it basically goes like this. Principle number, letter A, is providing services in response to emergencies or first response service. This is protection of people's lives. And also services related to protecting the integrity of the government of the state. The second of these principles, letter B, is protection of the infrastructure of the organization so that we can maintain the integrity of the Department of State Police and our programs. Principle letter C, support services to the entire criminal justice system. These include internal support, in part, for the Oregon State Police, and external support to our partners outside the state police. Principle letter D is the protection of natural resources, protection of all aspects of the state's natural resource system, including the protection of the environment and its fish and wildlife. And then the last principle, letter E, is other services under which, in many cases, we provide on contract to other partners. So according to these principles, then, we looked at the functions of the department and went about the process of prioritizing what's priority one through, on the 10% list, it's down through priority number 24. And if you look on that same table, you'll see both the number of priority and the principle or principles that are attached to that by way of describing our rationale. Excuse me. So, starting from the top, priority one, principle A, protection of emergency response capacity and protection of people and the integrity of the government. These are our primary enforcement programs in the patrol division. Priority two, principle B, protection of the integrity of the Department of State Police. This is my office, the Office of Professional Standards, through which we maintain the integrity of the department, our business support functions, debt service, etc.
Could you speak to, again, just trying to unpack what's there under human resources,
right,
and wanting to fully understand the different functions within human resources? You have the Office of the Superintendent.
Yes, ma'am.
Professional standards, and that means?
That's our Internal Affairs Department.
Internal Affairs, meaning?
Regulating the conduct of our employees.
Okay. Business support.
Right.
Includes what?
Well, we have our payroll functions, our personnel functions, our accounting functions, those types of things that we have to be able to dot the I's and cross the T's in a business environment so that we don't.
And it's basically the business support for the organization of just over 1,000 employees is where you have a lot of the functions that keep the ship moving on course are in the business office: training, personnel, fiscal, payroll, the quality control, internal audit, certain professional standards is all within that component.
And, Madam Chair, members of the committee, we place a very, very high value on the functions in this area. There are grant reporting requirements, contract administration requirements, and a host of other business functions that we just cannot afford to drop the ball on.
Madam Chair, continuing down the list of prioritization, below first section, human resources, number three, is category principle B as well. Still in human resources, it's the regional and patrol office. Central operations center, our dispatch centers, and field command within the regions. The three regions out there are part of the human resource structure as well. Priority four, principle B, is our information management division. That component there is our wireless radio infrastructure for the operation of the emergency response and radio system of the department, and various infrastructure support that supports that as well. Some of these are broken out as you go down the list, as you'll see as we go down, that are the same division, however, different components that we looked at that, based on our principles, we prioritized separately on different line items. Number five is principle C, forensic services, and these are the identification forensics. What we mean by that is those are the sciences and disciplines within your state crime lab system that tend to identify suspects to a major crime, such as your convicted offender database, which is called CODIS. You also have the DNA. And I know that's an acronym, but boy, don't ask me how to pronounce the scientific name of that, because I can't do it. But DNA is in that. We have TRACE, other crime scene disciplines that tend to identify suspects to major crime.
Madam Chair?
Representative Hannah.
As we're going through this, this is a good one to pick as a reference item. Would you help us to go from the 10% reduction page or the line 6, statewide criminal investigations, and reference it back to the line item of the priority list on the front page? so that we know where you took that from, so we can start to get be able to match these back and forth?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, yes. I have the list down here. What's the yeah, I'd like to get Ken to come up. Maybe you'd like to go through and then Ken can cross-check the list of the areas as we go down that where we took reductions. We could do that.
Just as a follow-up, I think if you get us on the right track, we'll begin to figure it out, but just help us to reference back and forth, because, for instance, on that one, now I'm coming to the other side trying to say where that would have come from. And that's what we need to be able to reference.
Sure.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Ken Weiss, Budget Director. We originally put this document together several weeks ago, and then after visiting with LFO, there were some recommendations that we regroup the list of priorities for reduction purposes. So when we first gave the instructions to our program people to list their programs and their criteria for their priorities, we did not necessarily keep the same identity of those program descriptions that they prepared when we did the reduction priority list. So I can kind of walk you through what we grouped into the reduction last page, but it wasn't what we started off with as the original instructions that we sent out to the program folks.
Mr. Wilson, feel free to jump in here.
Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee, the reasons for my suggestions were twofold. The first one being that in the priority list, which make up the bulk of this package, they really had grouped things into basically four or five categories and didn't rank from number one down to the bottom. And when the co-chairs took a look at that, they wanted things ranked one from the bottom. And then taking a look at that, I suggest you maybe have too many categories, because if you take a look at these two or three pages at the first part of that pack, you're probably talking about, and I haven't counted them recently, probably 30 or more items or something, which is difficult for you when you come down to it to try to organize that many in this agency. And when you get to public safety area generally, if you did this, you probably had 200 things or more to prioritize across all agencies if everyone took that route. So I think the trouble is, or the problem people are having are going through sort of a brand new priority list here on this 10% and what was there before. What I would suggest doing, and if the agency would be amenable to this, would be to continue working through this last page, because I think it sets out the priorities pretty well as they see it. And then I can work with the agency between now and the end of their presentation, then come back through on the last day and go through the priority list again, because then you will have a better understanding of each of the divisions and the bureaus. And this will give you sort of a good overview and see what their thinking is. Then you'll go through each of the major, you know, program areas, bureaus, divisions in the next couple days. Then if you come back to this, I think you have a better understanding of what their thinking was, and you also have some background of what the various programs are. So that would be my suggestion, Madam Chair.
Can I follow up?
Please.
I appreciate your input, and I'm willing to do however this would be. But I would suggest that it is very difficult without being able to pick where these numbers come from. And for me, I like to be able to look at the cut and go back over here and put together where it came from. And I think that's a onerous task for every one of us sitting here, to have to come over here and try to subtotal things that we don't know what to put together to come up with the cut. And that would not be my favorite method.
Well, together, members, we'll work our way through what is in front of us. And again, I will say what I always say to members of this committee. Please continue to ask questions that get you the fullest possible understanding of the information that's being presented. That's our job. That's why we're here. And with that said, please continue.
Madam Chair, the next item on the prioritization list is number 6, Principle A and C, Criminal Investigation Services from our Criminal Division. And those are, at that level, statewide major crime investigative work that the division is responsible to provide. A lot of that is in support of local law enforcement, local district attorney's offices. Also, some narcotic enforcement is also part of that, those service delivery within the criminal division. That one does have in our reductions for a 10% reduction, does have reductions in there listed out of the general fund. It is predominantly funded out of the general fund. Number 7, back to Information Management Division, Identification Services section, the next priority. And again, that's, you'll hear more detail about these program elements as the materials come up and talk about specific services and customers for each one of these disciplines. Number 8 is also Information Management Division, Criminal Justice Information System. CJIS is part of that function. Number 9, Principle B, Human Resources, and that's our training function within the department. That currently has approximately 3 FTE that are full-time responsible for training elements within the Department of State Police and provide those services internally. Number 10, Principle C, Patrol Division. These programs are different than the number one in that they provide support functions within your Uniform Patrol Division. They are internal functions such as collision reconstruction of crashes that occur, drug recognition experts, otherwise DRE is what that's called, our aggressive driving program that we implemented this last year. These are programs that do support the Patrol Division's efforts in some of their primary enforcement programs that are on the state and interstate highways. Number 11, Principle C, again, Forensics Division. This is different than the identification services that we talked about earlier. This is general forensics, those disciplines within the Forensics Division that do not tend to identify suspects to major crimes. They're more support for the forensics programs, and that's why they're listed separately. Number 12, Principle C, your state medical examiner office. That is the autopsy program. 13, Criminal Division of the Office of Public Safety and Security. Again, that is the terrorism office that will be operating under a contract to the newly created Office of Homeland Security for the state. Priority 14, Principle C, Criminal Division again, the Sex Offender Registration Program that is mandated by statute. That is the state registry of sex offenders based on state law that we oversee. Priority 14, Principle C, 15, Principle C, Forensics, Implied Consent, and that is the Implied Consent Program, the Intoxilizer Program that the state police oversees and certifies all of the breathalyzers that are in use by public safety agencies throughout the state. It's known as our Implied Consent Program. Number 16, Principle D, Fish and Wildlife Division. That's the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, Measure 66, primarily funded enforcement natural resource programs. And, of course, their troopers really are also involved in investigations as well. 17, Principle B, Information Management Division. To be the Enterprise Services section, our computers, infrastructure support for the organization's technology within the organization. 18, Principle E, Gaming Enforcement division that's lottery and tribal gaming. The, by statute and contract, we operate and provide security, regulatory security services for the State Lottery Commission, and also by tribal state compact, we provide regulatory services to the Native American governments within the state of Oregon that have gaming casinos. Priority 19, Principal A and E, Criminal Division, be the Capitol Mall contract that we have here with DAS and Legislative Administrative Committee, LAC, and also our Dignitary Protection Unit, which is a small unit that is assigned to the Capitol and to the Governor. Priority 20, Principal A and E, Patrol Division again. Contract services is what you have here at this priority level. Such things as our contract with the University, Oregon State University, for police services. We have some state parks department contracts as well for patrolling various parks, the state fair annually, and we contract with Department of Motor Vehicles for vehicle identification number, or VIN, inspections at our various field patrol offices. Priority 21, Principal D, Fish and Wildlife Division. Again, at the level of contract services, at this level of priority, and that is the Marine Board contract, our contract with the Department of Environmental Quality. Priority 22, Principal E, is Criminal Division. It's the HIDA, high-intensity drug trafficking area, work that we do in support of law enforcement's efforts on those areas designated as high-intensity drug trafficking areas within the state of Oregon. Those are pass-through dollars, essentially, to the HIDA effort within the state of Oregon. Number 23, Principal E, Gaming Division, again, and that's the boxing and wrestling by statute. That is underneath your Department of State Police, and they provide regulatory security services, background investigations on that industry. And finally, the last priority, 24, is Principal E, Criminal Division, and that is the Tobacco Compliance Task Force work that we are undertaking, and also the DHS Juvenile Tobacco Use Program, Enforcement Program, and sting operations that are part of that mandated program within Oregon.
Senator Winters, I want to add the clarification that the federal government is also involved in that little mandate that we have, and if we don't have a certain level of compliance, we run the risk of losing more than these dollars that are noted here. I'm sorry for my voice loss, but.
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, that's absolutely correct. A lot of people are losing their voices today.
But I, for members who aren't familiar with the guidelines surrounding these dollars, you may want to explain what's at risk when we don't do the sting operations.
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, there are federal dollars that are at risk. I don't have the exact number, but if that was not being done in Oregon, I believe the state would no longer qualify for some of the federal funds that come into the state because of that program that's in place today. We will certainly can get the amount of funds. It is a large amount.
Sorry. Representative Hansen.
Well, I think, and I don't want to speak ill of the co-chairs because we don't want to do that at all, but I think this format tends to lead us down some paths that are sort of silly. You know, that, for example, boxing and wrestling, we haven't cut positions here in $78,000 other funds on the earlier things, but yet to get to the other fund cuts, you've included $600,000 in other funds for tribal gaming. And since they're all other funds, I mean, I just don't understand really why we're going through the exercise at all. And it sort of, you know, distorts our. I'm afraid it makes you look like you're distorting your priorities to meet these kind of artificial constraints.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, we've made our best faith effort to comply with the requirement to take a 10% reduction, come up with some kind of a plan in every fund category. And we actually feel pretty good about the establishment of these principles, the A through E, provides us a framework with some rationale that we think we can defend and make sense. Things that are most important to the protection of human life or to the integrity of the state government, we've placed them the highest priority, and things that are contract services that really don't fit into that category are toward the bottom. But we understand what you're saying. And
I have a question about the forensics. And help me better understand your thinking and the criteria with the result that the forensics piece would have a lower priority and take such a hit. I'm thinking of, you know, recent history around cuts to forensics and needing to restore and get us to a level where we're able to respond to requests for service out there. And what's being proposed here goes right back in the opposite direction. So help us understand your thinking.
Madam Chair, I'll try if my voice will hold. If not, I'll pass to the Colonel. But we certainly, this I think goes to the one of the challenges of putting priority numbers on things. Forensic services are critical and they're critical to the entire system. Our partners depend on them. About 90% about 90% of what we do there is for others in the criminal justice system. We know it's incredibly important to them as it is to us to provide those services. At the same time, 500 people a year are getting killed on our highways. And we certainly believe it's our number one priority, our number one responsibility to do what we can to protect those lives. And so, besides that, in this chart, with a shift of all the patrol dollars into lottery funds, one is left with trying to come up with a general fund reductions that are necessary to hit the 10% mark. And the only two substantial general fund categories left in our budget are forensics and criminal. That's where all the money is. So you have to, if you're going to go through this exercise, and by the way, I haven't said this yet because I don't have any voice, we don't think any of this makes any sense. I mean, the state police has been cut and cut and cut. And I can't point you to one item on this page that I would say, you know, we think it's good public policy if you cut this or that in our budget. So we're sort of left caught in a process that requires that we come up with the reductions in the general fund category, and really the only two wells you can dip into are criminal and forensics. We don't think that's a good idea, but we have no choice but except to provide you with the information that the law requires us to do.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a fairly somewhat different view than my good colleague, the representative from North Portland, in terms of the request to look at 10% cuts and to look at them broadly. I think we spend a great deal of time looking at general fund and lottery fund expenditures, but I think everyone here, including my good colleague from North Portland, would admit that we have a responsibility to examine all state expenditures, and I would hope, although it's never really been the case entirely, that in another committee here that's considering ODOT's budget, which is literally all, except for a tiny amount of general fund, all other funds, that they would receive the same scrutiny that you are receiving, actually, in terms of expenditures, because that's how the process should actually work. But the one thing I wanted to comment on and have the superintendent comment on is that, to one extent, I think part of the difficulty in the state police is that you have developed literally into two law enforcement agencies in one. One that supports all the other law enforcement activities in the state, including your own, and then your own direct line law enforcement responsibilities.
Yes, sir.
I think there's actually a benefit to having those two together because it keeps the people that are providing those services more grounded in what the needs are actually on the ground level. But I think that's a difficulty the superintendent is always faced with because everything that's here is important to the superintendent. Some of those things in terms of support services might be ranked particularly higher by, not in a negative way, I'm not saying it that, but by sheriffs in the state and by chiefs of police in the state. And so I think that's the constant position the superintendent of the state police has put in.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin is correct. And you've stated it well. There's that which is our mission, and there's that which we do in support of others' missions, and they're both very, very important. If you ask someone outside the state police what's their priority, they're going to give you a different answer. And that their answer isn't wrong. It's just that's what they need from us. We have our own mission as well as it relates to transportation safety on the state and interstate highway system. That's our job. And, of course, our partners don't see that as important to them as the support services that we provide to them as well. So it is a balancing act. We have an interesting construct here. You know, in the Northeast United States, it's very common to have state police structures like ours. It's not common in the West. We're an anomaly here. In California and in Washington, we have highway patrols. They're not state police organizations. And because we're structured as we are, well, there's a certain efficiencies that come out of that. It's just that you end up sort of sometimes having in these declining budget environments, pitting one element of your service against another in what is a very ugly exercise. In another state, a forensics department might be its own separate entity. It is in some states, a Bureau of Investigation. So, but here it's all one. And you're exactly correct. We face that dilemma. We embrace it. It's just part of the way it is. But it never goes away.
I have a question about your organizational chart and the human resources part of the organization. There's a training function that is part of your human resources department. Is that's accurate?
Correct.
Training. Is there a training function also as a part of the professional standards?
No. The captain that oversees professional standards also oversees the training people. And it's kind of a misnomer because the training division section is like three people. They have no supervisor in there, so the captain of professional standards looks after those people. That's why I think one of the unfortunate realities in an organization like ours after the budget history we've had
if I were to talk to my counterparts in other states and explain to them that I have three people assigned to training for an organization our size, a statewide law enforcement organization, I think we were crazy. But that's what we have left. You know, we just cut and cut.
Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would that include discussion about our new training facility? Because, I mean, when you combine the two, it would look like we have a tremendous training facility in Oregon, along with a fair number of people appointed to deal with training. So even though it's not in your agency, we sure have a lot of resources aimed at it. What do your comments... would you make a comment that that is an effective training or it's not in the right place?
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, the training people that we have in our budget are like firearms coordinators, training coordinators. They're not, they do some training themselves, but they mostly keep track of the training that people are supposed to get. And that won't really change when we merge with the training of basic recruit training with DPSST. That won't have an effect on that. We will still, you know, there's kind of two major discussions. Thank you, Doug. There's two major discussions in training. One is, how do you train basic police recruits? We're going to join up with DPSST in that joint venture. And we'll actually do part of our training with DPSST, and we'll do more on our own, either before or after the training. They're only going to do 16 weeks. Our training curriculum now is about 22 weeks. So we will continue to train beyond the 16 week for the training of basic troopers. But that's just the beginning of the story, because every police officer needs annual training. Management training, self-defense and firearms training. And it's constantly things that training that needs to occur to keep people's skills up and to keep them abreast of emerging issues in our profession. So training in police, probably in any organization, but training it. Excuse me. Training in a police organization is a time-consuming and never-ending undertaking, and that we have just three people assigned to that is not much.
Can I follow up, please?
Representative Hannah, and then Mr. Wilson has a comment for the good of our understanding.
Okay. I'm wondering if you would help us understand what percent of your training for, and I'm not talking about management training, but I'm talking about police or patrol training. I mean, you might be able to square me away a little bit. I mean, at this committee, we've heard from the SPAT department, and now we're hearing from you, but I'd like to understand what percent of your training happens at that facility versus how much more you're going to do outside of that facility.
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, if I understand your question correctly, what I think we're going to do in partnership with DPSST at the new facility is a portion of our basic recruit training. The rest of our ongoing training needs probably continue to be done in-house with our own people.
I think that to further expand on your answer, Superintendent, it would be helpful to have a list of trainings that happen through your department that don't happen at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, so that we can see where the distinction is. And then also in the governor's budget, again, this is before the 10% cut. Well, in the governor's budget, you have about $900,000 for training. What does that $900,000 buy?
Okay.
That isn't at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. Does that kind of kind of help get at what you're...
I think to a great degree. I mean, we're going to sit here and decide on both. And, you know, if we're putting, and I can't remember, Doug, maybe you can help me, what the number, total number for that facility. It's a big one.
Well, it's $75 million just for the facility. It's a
yeah. And
a lot more to as the
superintendent indicates, you know, if you just took 16 weeks out of 22, that's only 70-some percent of their training, and they're doing another 28% outside of that. And I have a question about where the training is happening and why, and where it's most efficient.
Well, there's in the question of why does the Department of Oregon State Police do their own training? Why doesn't all that happen at one facility? There's another question for
Chair,
you.
Chair, glad to answer. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we currently we do the DPSST Academy is 10 weeks. When they open the new facility, they hope to go to 16. They will go to 16. We have been a supporter of that effort. It's clearly needed. It's needed for all law enforcement in the state to elevate that level of training that they can get someplace. Historically, the state police has always done its own training. that also is not unusual in the United States. We, however, have embraced the notion of training jointly with DPSST to the extent that that can happen. They don't anticipate being able to do more than 16 weeks, and the state police is not interested in eliminating some of the training that our officers now get. Neither do our partners, the sheriffs and the chiefs, want to see us ratchet back the level of our training. The goal ought to be to get the rest of the training up to that same level. I don't know. That's not my department, and it's not my place to say whether that's probable or even possible in the near future. But we wholeheartedly support the establishment of this DPSST Academy. We want to be their partner. We are going to be their partner. We think we have something to offer, and we have something to gain, and we're going to do that. It's just that we intend to continue to provide the balance of the training that our officers now get, the DPSST is not going to be able to provide to our officers either before or after they go through the 16 weeks. And, you know, we're a little bit in a position of being an anomaly in the state in that we have, unlike a local jurisdiction that has the opportunity to have, let's say the city of Portland, for example, or any other local jurisdiction, they've got a lot of contact with their people in either one or a small number of physical locations. We've got one shot to get these people trained, and once they leave the State Police Academy, they're off to the four corners of the state. And in some cases, we won't ever get that group back together again. So we have taken the approach to do the best job we can training them in the first place, because that's the shot we get, and it happens to work. The money that you mentioned, the $900,000, that is a slice of the CFAA money. Criminal fines and assessments accounts, I almost had to pay. That has historically been routed our way to help defray some of the costs of our recruit training. I don't know if it covers all the costs or not. It probably depends on how much training we do in a given biennium. In the years when we were laying people off, we probably didn't spend it all on training. But that is what that money is for, and we will continue to need to do basic training for those officers, and whether or not that dollar figure stays the same or changes in the future, you know, we'll just respond however is appropriate at the time.
Senator Devlin?
Madam Chair, Superintendent, I kind of see a difference in this in a sense, in that I see BPS Border Police Standard Safety and Training as providing basic training.
You're avoiding pain.
As providing basic training, providing some advanced training, provide some specialized training. But I would suspect that almost any law enforcement organization in the state that's of any size, and probably the smaller ones wish that they could do this, have some type of internal training function also. Because many of their staff, and this very good thing, many of the superintendent's troopers will choose to stay troopers and senior troopers their entire career. And they may not, that may be 25 years. And there's a need for ongoing training that occurs within those kind of departments, whether it's a sheriff's office or a city police department. And I would suspect that anything, any entity of any size is going to have an internal training function. And to be able to send personnel, if you were chief of police in Ontario and send personnel for training anytime you needed to have training to Salem, would be a terrible expense. So I think we can expect that even though we're going to provide a much better training environment for the Board of Police Standard Safety and Training, that we will still have training activities in law enforcement entities throughout the state.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, that's absolutely correct. And I will add also that not all the training that needs to occur in law enforcement will be possible at the new academy. We're going to continue to our relationship with the military department at Camp Rylea, because some kinds of training, SWAT training, for example, will not be possible at the new academy. Our partners agree with that. They understand that. We also train jointly with our civil disturbance team. We call it our mobile response team, crowd control, that kind of stuff. We train jointly with Portland and other agencies at Camp Rylea. It's an environment suitable for that. We have and will continue to train with our partners and share our facility and our expertise with them. Have historically done that. We'll continue to do it in the future.
Representative Hansen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I hope this whole arena stays kind of fluid, because there's going to be a lot of opportunities for everybody in terms of working together. Rather than bringing a state trooper back to Salem from a rural part, if they could participate with sheriff's training or for marksmanship routine stuff, to be able to work in a local area with local officers as one way to advance it, right? might be an option, and certainly, but clearly there will be individual training that each organization will have to continue.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, we agree and we will.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
If I may just add on to the discussion as well, is the Greg Williford for the record. On that training, at the new academy, we also do anticipate to do our those in-service schools, management schools, to do them at the new facility that we would go elsewhere currently for. But the training that beyond the basic recruit school, the 16 weeks plus school that you really need to do to keep your risk consumable, is in the areas of firearms, defensive tactics, and special operations, such as the superintendent mentioned, SWAT and our mobile response teams. The trooper on the road, it's a trimester schedule on the most sensitive training elements, and that's the use of force, firearms, and defensive tactics. And that's beyond the basic academy training. That's something that has to be maintained. If you want to keep your risk management down, it needs to be maintained at a regular schedule and at certain high-level standards.
Senator Winter?
Madam Chair, I have a question that I think my memory serves me well, that one of the things that was mentioned with Director Menace was that the 16 weeks of training that they're providing is really below national standards. And so if that's below national standards, I think hopefully at some point we bring them up to standard. One of the things that I think we've always looked to with the state police is I can't recall where we've had the state police in the newspaper having not done their job properly. Their standards that they have set over the years are those standards that I think are high and serve the citizens well. But I point that out because as we look at not only retaining patrol and our state troopers, but also I would not want to be in a position as state of Oregon of saying that we want to be at a reduced level of any of our law enforcement agents. Staff and our agents. I'm bothered that to think that we're adopting Melissa's operation, something that is below what is nationally recognized as the training of people who protect us. But I had to point that out because I thought my memory when I heard that one figure and Doug, what is the national standard?
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, I think it is 22 or 23 weeks, which your current school is around that number, is it not?
Yes, it is. We're usually reviewing that to see if we need to add more subject matter.
Which brings me to another question. What kind of extra training is required, or is there extra training required in dealing with our methamphetamine epidemic? And I know that the troopers are very much involved with that particular issue.
Well, Madam Chair or Senator Winters, the basic recruit, I don't have a specific recall, but I think it's safe to say that at basic recruit training, they're getting a basic understanding of narcotics enforcement, drug trafficking, and we would typically see that type of training being the subject of some more specialized classwork post basic recruit training that we're not covering that very well, even ourselves in basic recruit school.
Second question, are you training or assisting in training some of the counties in SWAT activities?
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, yes.
While we're on the training line of questioning, you know, I'm starting to feel like we need an exhaust fan or a window.
Chair, do you want to repeat your observation from about 2 weeks ago about what the Capitol was, a giant
petri dish? I said that before you came in today. Anyway, let's keep our water and vitamin C and tea going here. The question I have related to training has to do with all that is required now through the states around our concerns and fears around terrorism. I note that among your priorities is the Office of Public Safety and Security. It's your number 13 priority without an assigned principal. But clearly, there's some work going on there that must be in conjunction with other departments.
Yes.
Could you describe and define what that piece looks like and what should we be concerned about?
The Office of Public Safety and Security is a small unit of people that we basically created out of by redirecting other resources following September 11th.
Is that this on your organizational chart, the one at the bottom?
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay, because it says Office of Public Safety, it doesn't say security. So
right,
yes,
ma'am, that's
just
correct.
Add that. Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
We basically, after September 11th, well, I recall a conversation with Governor Kitzhaber. He said, what do you need? So I'm not sure what we need exactly, but we've got to do something. On September 11th, we had one person assigned to intelligence gathering in the state of Oregon. And we had previously had an intelligence unit that Colonel Wilford headed up in the 90s, but that unit was the casualty of budget cuts back in those days. So when September 11th rolled around, we had one person left assigned to doing intel work, and that was largely on our kind of homegrown Oregon domestic terrorists that are in the state, always have been, and still are. So the governor said, what do you need? I'm not sure exactly, but we got to working on it. I was appointed as the Homeland Security Advisor for the state. I started meeting with other state Homeland Security Advisors in the region and in D.C. And very shortly decided we had to put together a small unit, which was the Office of Public Safety and Security. I went back to the governor and told him I needed $1 million. Well, we assigned the people, but I never signed the money. So we established this unit to do several things. One, we had to get involved in the Joint Terrorism Task Force operations being run by the FBI. And we have been in that and continue to be in that, and we will continue to be in that. It's critical. It is our connectivity to the federal Homeland Security counterterrorism efforts. It's a law enforcement environment only, but that's where, if there's information that we need to have in the state of Oregon or that I excuse me, that I need to have, that's where I'm going to get it. So we're involved in that. We also have a person assigned to help me with the name over at DOJ. The Oregon Criminal Intelligence Unit.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm losing my voice.
We have a member assigned, for the record, Greg Wilford, assigned to the Oregon Department of Justice Criminal Intelligence Unit, and that person primarily has been involved with Oregon DOJ and FBI on domestic terrorism elements. Oh, no. Madam Chair, I think I owe the pig some money.
Isn't that a shame?
I'll pay on my way out.
And here, I got you covered.
Oh, thank you. This is your credit card, sir?
Yeah.
The application of resources is pretty small, but we are connected in the right positions, and that's primarily with the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force, which is
U.S. Attorney.
And the U.S. Attorney's Office and the Oregon Department of Justice. And we look at both in those efforts.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Colonel, why is DOJ and Homeland Security having different offices on terrorism? What's different about DOJ's Department of Justice and the Homeland Defense Office? You said that you're working with the Department of Justice Intel Terrorism Office, and also we've got a Homeland Security. Why do we need it? What are they doing different?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, there are different functions within each one of those offices. The Oregon Department of Justice component that we have is also on intelligence, and it doesn't go just there. It goes to the Joint Terrorism Task Force, FBI, in support of both international and domestic terrorism investigations and intelligence operations. The newly created Department of Oregon Homeland Security would also have, beyond Homeland Security oversight, the governor's office would also have emergency preparedness and response, the traditional functions of Oregon emergency management for the preparing and exercising of Homeland Security initiatives versus law enforcement efforts.
Madam Chair, we'll have to look into that, because that's duplication, because that's the mission of the new Homeland Security was reported also to be monitoring terrorism.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, they, by contract, would have the state police investigative arm as part of their organizational structure and operations as well. So they are responsible for that as well and report to the governor's office in that regard. They are not a law enforcement exclusive entity in this effort, but they have our state police resources assigned to them under contract.
Please continue, and then I'll answer my
question. Quick follow-up, Madam Chair. Thank you. when we first looked at the bill that's out there to create the Homeland Security, this committee looked at it real fast. We got a long way to go. Is it your position that we're doing okay, or we're progressing along with the establishment of that agency proper timing and using all, I understand there's several hundred thousand million dollars of federal funds that we haven't sought either to establish Oregon's Homeland Security agency. And, you know, we're not exempt from this threat. We've already had a couple of local situations. So would you like to comment? Do you think that this change of taking your people and putting them in there and getting rid of the Office of Management, Emergency Management, is working or progressing satisfactorily? And speak for the superintendent, if you could.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, we think the approach to establish the Office of Homeland Security for the state of Oregon is a good one. We think that we do have a tremendous amount of work ahead of us. I asked the governor after about 2.5 years or so of trying to be Oregon's Homeland Security advisor to the governor and to Tom Ridge and be the superintendent of the state police. I said, this isn't working. This can't be side work for somebody. It's a full-time job if we're going to do it right. There's all these federal resources it's sort of intermittently coming down the pipe. We need to be doing a good job in Oregon of utilizing those things for the right kinds of programs. And I had a job before September 11th, and I can't do it. I cannot do it effectively. And so he responded and appointed Beverly Stilwell to be the Homeland, to head up this new effort. And I think it's the right move. Is it perfect? No. There's a lot of work to be done. In my view, when people in their private homes know what it means, what they should do if the threat level changes from orange to yellow or yellow to red, we'll have gotten somewhere. When every police agency, every hospital, every fire department knows what those things mean, you know, because then how they know it is because we've done all the planning and coordinating and training, then we're going to be somewhere. We are very vulnerable. And the way to change that condition is to put people in place and give them the time and the resources to be able to get at this work. And I think establishing this entity is a step in the right direction. But I also think it's going to be years before we're there. But it's a better move to make than what we had done to date. We haven't quite accomplished what we should have in the last 3 years. And we've done a lot of good things. We've done a lot of great work. We are in better shape than we were on September 11th. And I could go on and on about that. But I think that there are a lot of considerations, some of which are political, and they're not totally within the state's control, that make it difficult to get to the place where I think most of us agree we need to be. I will say also we're in a lot better shape than some states who are farther behind us, so everything's relative, but I think it's a good move.
Representative Hanna.
Madam Chair, this is not on that subject matter. It goes back to the training issue. So
let me just find out, are there any other questions or comments on this subject?
Madam Chair, I would suggest when we get to the Homeland Security Agency, we may want to ask Craig Campbell to come in from the governor's office and sort of talk about a couple things. The Homeland Security roles, maybe the split between from the state police to the Homeland Security, as well as sort of the integration of Department of Justice, Homeland Security, state police. You have a better feel for what their thinking was on this. It may be the best approach before we do any work sessions, have them come in to discuss it.
Madam Chair, thank you. And Doug, thank you for those comments, and I agree. It seemed like the superintendent was enthusiastic about this subject, and his voice came back on that. But I agree with him. It's something we need to seriously, and I look forward to that testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I may, the last point on Homeland Security is that in our agency, thinking as we think about Homeland Security for the future, or the Office of Public Safety and Security, the same way we do about the Gaming Enforcement Division. The game, in terms of our structure, the Gaming Enforcement Division is assigned to the lottery. There are people, but they work at the lottery. And that's exactly the way this Office of Public Safety and Security is going to work. There still are people who work at Homeland Security. And so there's an exchange of resources that goes on, but we think it's best to situate our people under that structure to do even a better job than they could do if we were in our own little silo.
I have one additional question on this subject, and then we'll go to Representative Hanna. You mentioned that prior to September 11th, you had one person assigned to intelligence. Since then, I'm not clear on how many people are in that area now, and is that person, that one person who was assigned to intelligence, still there, or where is that person now?
Yes, Madam Chair, the individual person who was assigned still is. We originally thought this was going to be a supervisor and five police officers of different specialties. And it's not that big now. It's the supervisor and
three.
Okay. So, if we were going to try to do what we were doing in the 90s, which was run our own separate intelligence section and not be partnered up with these other task forces, it would take a lot more people than as it did then. But now we've simply plugged into these different task forces, and those people are there full time. And if there's an operation that's going on and we need to augment that with officers to execute search warrants or whatever, we do that situationally, but there's just several people there on a full-time basis.
Any further questions or comments before we shift subjects and open a window? Okay, Representative Hanna.
I think we'll just be quick. Thank you, Madam Chair. Back to the training issue. For your in-house training of troopers, what percent of that time or resource is used in training them to perform the commercial vehicle enforcement inspection?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, I'm going to have to get you an up-to-date figure. I don't have it off the top of my head.
Okay.
We will get it to you.
Okay. Where would you like to go next, Superintendent?
Mm-hmm. Ready for Merrill's name?
Well, I guess what I would like to do, Madam Chair, is ask if, to the committee's satisfaction, we've talked about this 10% reduction in the list, or if you want to go over that even further. If not, I would propose that we move to Major Spirit and let him start talking about individual program areas.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Don't rework all the numbers for me, but if of the roughly 70 million that's moved from general fund to lottery funds, if those were back into the general fund, how would that change your priorities, or would it?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, probably wouldn't, because we have some patrol functions already on this list for the ones that we think we could cut, mm-hmm. if we had to, which are these specialty accident reconstruction, this kind of thing, but with only 329 people assigned for the entire state of Oregon, we don't have 24-hour coverage anymore anywhere in the state police. I never thought I'd see the day. And the idea of further reducing that uniform patrol division, goes exactly opposite of what I think our number one responsibility is, which is to try to save people's lives on the highway, and B, actually represents an even greater danger to the remaining officers themselves, who are already out there under circumstances in terms of availability to backup and whatnot that are keeping me awake at night. So, if I had general fund, if that was all general fund and patrol in our 1A category, I wouldn't cut it.
Senator Winters? Could you provide, if it's too much trouble, don't do it, but could you provide a historical document of going back further than 2001-03 as to, and where I'm going is when you were at full capacity, before there were funding issues, what did the state troopers look like? So that we've got some trend lines, that would be very helpful. And it may be, and I can't remember what year it was when you were begin to have to deal with the issue of reductions when you became a part of general fund.
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, we just happen to have those documents, maybe not right this moment, but that work has been done. The historical impact on the patrol division since 1980, when we came out of the Highway Trust Fund, and the intervening 25 years. We can make copies of the documents right here. We had 665 people, or if my memory's correct. Yeah, 665 in patrol in 79-81, compared to 329 today. About half, a little less than half. We can give you all that information presented in any different way you'd like to see.
You know, it's interesting. As a now veteran on the committee, this is a piece of information that has been requested every session since I've been here. So for those of us who've been here for, well, I go back to 1991 and the special session of 71, we should have a collection of those documents all telling us the same thing. Anyway,
yes.
It's always good to request the information, and I really appreciate Senator Winters doing that because it does benefit the new members and folks who are still trying to get their arms around some of these issues. But, you know, there's a point at which you do something with the information that you get, you know, and I'd like to think that's where we are now.
We have a one-pager that actually portrays what the senator asked about. We can back that up with any amount of detail people want, but that tells the story.
That's very good. Mr. Wilson, did you have a comment? And Representative Hanson?
No, I'm just thinking that sort of looks like my investment portfolio.
Madam Chair, I was just going to mention that I've asked the agency, and they said it shouldn't be any problem to integrate this priority list with the numbers from the front pages. They should have that done by tomorrow. I would still suggest, though, after they go through their presentation, that the subcommittee come back to this and quickly go through it at the end to sort of refresh after you hear the background information to go back through the priority list, because you will have to be ranking these yourself in a couple weeks.
And I think it will be important to have a deeper understanding of what's happening on the criminal side. Also, again, appreciating Senator Winter's request about methamphetamine and what does increased enforcement in that area mean. Doug, help me with this question. And maybe I dreamt this one too. But is there any place where information is being collected around, or is there a document that captures all of the legislation that has been introduced around methamphetamine, all of the recommendations that have been made around methamphetamine, whether they came out of the governor's task force or some other task force? Is there a document that captures what that big picture looks like?
I'm not sure if there's a single document. I mean, there's the governor's report. There's a list of what I'll call governor-sponsored bills, for lack of a better term. And then, of course, there's been a number of bills introduced by individual members, some of which are on this subcommittee. We could put together such a list. In fact, I would guess that probably Craig Prinz is doing that.
and tracking that as a real, so we'll work with them and get you that list.
That would be very helpful to have that information in front of us at the earliest possible date. My concern is that our efforts to date are so fragmented. We have a lot of activity and a lot of well-intentioned efforts going on, but it's not connected.
Right.
From where I sit, it's not connected, and it needs to be connected and coordinated, and not only coordinated, but you know, priorities assigned. What's going to happen first from a public policy standpoint? What gets funded first from a public policy standpoint? So again, we need that document or that grid, if you will, that helps us look at the methamphetamine piece.
Okay. Madam Chair, thank you for requesting that. It would also be helpful for me from your standpoint of what is needed as far as the state police in looking at, I'm calling it the high-level person that comes through I-5 that I don't know the technical term for them, but those individuals that we know that are transporting them from California, Mexico, all the way up to Canada, and the ones that we would really like to be able to put away. And what resource are needed in order to get there, including the dogs, I understand.
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative Winters, we'd be happy to respond to that. We appreciate the insertion of our recommendation in the governor's budget of this 8-person methamphetamine initiative or task force in our budget, in the recommended budget from his office. But as the chair stated, there's no one believes that 8 people could conquer the methamphetamine problem in Oregon, and will require a tremendous amount of coordination and partnership with people. Yet at one point in the discussions that led up to the governor's report, Doug mentioned it. Now the title of that report escapes me, but at one point there was a discussion about as many as 60 people being assigned to such a task force. The problem that methamphetamine is creating in our state and the nation, for that matter, is clearly epidemic in nature and one that should require our highest attention. It's absolutely ravaging our communities.
Superintendent, the high-intensity drug trafficking area.
Yes, ma'am.
How does that relate to the methamphetamine coordination that we're talking about? Are they one and the same?
Probably not, Madam Chair. I mean, they're all working drugs, but the HIDAs are targeted to specific geographic areas, and it's federal money that gets passed through largely to local jurisdictions. And only a few places in Oregon. We need to get at this methamphetamine issue across the state. And so they're separate initiatives.
Okay.
Not that there won't be some information sharing and crossover of casework, but they're not the same.
Yeah, I ask the question because, again, we need to understand where there is an intersection beginning there.
I think, if I may, Madam Chair, when Captain Mowry is in here talking about the Criminal Investigation Division and its missions and priorities, he'd probably be able to give you a much more detailed answer than I can at this point. That's his area of expertise, and he will be in here shortly, within the next few days.
Madam Chair, when I asked the question on training and particularly the SWAT training, and my reason for asking that question is because of that need in this particular arena. I did have the opportunity of going on a drug bus with Marion County, and looking at the sophistication of the, even within what people think is just mom and pops, but there's some sophisticated individuals out there that you do need some extra training. You need very skilled professional individuals to go in and do those tests, and that was my reason for wanting to know how engaged you were with counties and cities to help train their personnel in some of these strategies and techniques.
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, our answer to that is anybody who asks us for help on training, we'll help them. They don't all ask, but if they do, I can't remember us ever telling somebody no. So.
Just as an aside, I remember that when we had Peter Ozan here, Executive Director of the Public Defense Services Corporation, his admonition, his advice to us was that with regard to methamphetamine enforcement, we needed a strategy that allowed us to go after what he called the big fish, as opposed to the little minnows. And so hearing that from him leads me to wonder how that conversation or how his advice and recommendation is being heard, shared, thought about, coordinated. Again, are we on a path to a strategy that says that's what we're going to do, or are we still trying to figure this all out in terms of where to put the enforcement dollar? And certainly we as a committee have something to say about that in terms of our recommendations to the co-chairs and to Full Ways and Means. So I guess what I'm saying is food for thought for all of us.
Madam Chair, I think the answer to some of the questions you just posed would be a different answer at different levels, cities, counties, the state, and the federal government. As the state police, we see our place in this discussion to be not at the user level, distribution level of the minnows, as you described, but rather to try to target much higher level transporters and producers of these drugs, or the proceeds from the drugs, and to disrupt those distribution networks. And that's where the state probably can best help. At the local community level, I'm not sure that I mean, this is not my argument necessarily, but, you know, they cleaned up New York by paying attention to the small stuff.
That's right.
And made a tremendously safer community out of the city of New York by paying attention to all the little things. And the big things kind of took care of themselves. So there are different philosophies, but I think for the state police and for our budget, we would love to have an opportunity to take whatever level of staffing we may have and try to target that higher level distributor or criminal enterprise type of organizations and take them out.
Well, please continue.
The last thing I would like to comment about, Madam Chair, is our affirmative action efforts. And to say that for the last 5 or 6 years that I can speak to personally, we've made a very concentrated effort in trying to attract, recruit, hire, and train a workforce that is truly representative of the community we serve. We are doing this, running, you know, head to head with everybody else in law enforcement, at least, that are trying to do the same thing. And we're fairly pleased with our successes in the several. I'm just talking about now for this discussion, for the sake of our sworn recruit officers. We were doing okay. I would say maybe even a little better than okay. We've always viewed the targets that have been given to us by the State Affirmative Action Office as the floor, not the ceiling, and have tried to do the very best we could in this regard. But the one thing that really threw us completely out of whack was when we had the big layoff of 2003. We basically laid off every trooper we'd hired for 4 years. And we got some of those people back, most of those people back, I should say. We didn't fare nearly as well getting the women back that we had laid off as we did the rest of the group. And so, from my perspective, being someone that's been trying to, I've met with Peggy Ross, I've met with her predecessor, I've tried to do everything we can think of in terms of trying to make sure that we are seen by the community as a desirable employer. Because I think that's where it starts. You have to be seen by the community as somebody that they want to work for. Otherwise, they're not coming to work for you, no matter how much you think you're trying to recruit everybody.
Superintendent?
Yes, ma'am.
Again, just for clarity, why were you not able to bring back all of the women and people of color?
I'm not sure exactly, Madam Chair. We just, when we offered everybody their job back, not everybody took us up on that. I think we lost, I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but about 20% or so of those people we laid off, we just didn't get them back. And I don't have an answer for you as to why, what the rationale was, why some people said, yeah, we'll come back, and why others said no. But in addition to those police officers, a good number of the people of the not...
The way that, you know, the way I'm hearing this and the way I'm reading it too, because you captured the information in your text, it were to understand then that you were able to rehire all of the men who were laid off. Is that accurate?
No, that's not accurate.
Okay,
no.
Then I think you might want to look at restating what's here, because it's not clear.
Okay. Now I'm going to have to read this page.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Hammond.
I think to the point you mentioned, and it does read pretty bad, OSP was not able to bring back all the women and people of color due to concerns about the department's funding and potential for future layoff.
Yeah, that Madam Chair, is Representative Hammond, I apologize for the way that reads, because it does lead one to believe that the men said, yeah, we can come back under these circumstances, but the women and people of color said, no, we can't. And that's not accurate. The fact is, people, without respect to their gender or their ethnicity, there were plenty of people that said, I can't live like this. I can't come back to work for you with no probability or reason to believe that I'm going to still have a job. And I would say that was the general answer of everybody that said no. While some had moved on to other employment and got a higher paying job, if you will, the general answer that people gave was, you know, I got bills to pay and a family to feed and I can't live like this. So it's not something that one group of people said, one subgroup said, that the rest of the subgroup didn't say.
Madam Chair, can I follow up?
Oh, certainly.
That whole paragraph has some... And it's easy to set on the side and do this, so keep that in mind, but you could take some shots at it. But you might, it says 129 troopers were laid off and 102 were rehired. And then if you read the rest of the text, it kind of leads you to think that 102 of the people that were rehired were all part of the 129. And so it'd be easy for us to sit here and say, well, tell us about the 27 who didn't come back. What did their mix look like? But it might be a better measurement to say, here's what the 129 looked like prior to, and here's what the 102 looked like afterwards, instead of that combination, because it probably wouldn't work.
Madam Chair, with your permission, I would like to have an opportunity to rework this document a little bit and bring it back to you later.
As you're doing that, you might want to look at that next paragraph as well. Which needs some further explanation. You describe the number of individuals who applied for the most recent recruit school. That's the 1,687. And then of that group, 206 were women. That's what you're telling us, 206?
Yes.
Or 12.2%. And then 1,481 were men, or 87.8%. People of color within that same group of recruits, the 1,687, represented 11.1%, but you don't tell us a number. What's the actual okay. number of applicants there?
Okay. And likewise, a couple of other percentages are absent numbers in the rest of the paragraph.
Yes. What is monster.com?
That's what I was thinking.
It is a job search recruiting tool, I guess is the best way to say that.
Representative Hansen.
No, I guess we haven't been looking for work lately. That's the main search engine that people use now.
Although it's not a particularly attractive title for a potential police officer. But
well, probably not.
That's where I was going. Thank you.
The part I was wondering about, it says the next recruit class is scheduled for September 1, 2004. What has that...
That's also a typo.
Okay.
05.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I think this is a piece of document taken out of the agency request budget. It was due, I guess, due September 1, probably.
Okay.
So this is a document that is utilized from another source. That school has been completed as of last month during January sometime, if I'm not
mistaken.
Yes.
Yes. I've got them here. Just bear with me a second.
Can I make a comment?
Yes.
I mean, even though they're going to correct these figures and come back with better percentages, I am pleased that they actually came back with numbers and percentages and more detail than what we see in some of the other documents. So, some of them have not had positions.
Yes. A good comment, Senator Winter. Other comments or observations, questions on the affirmative action report?
And now I know the question monster.com.
What are the challenges, Superintendent, around your 2-year and 6-year plan that you would want the committee to be aware of?
I guess my answer to that, Madam Chair, is that I guess we're going to have to. I'm worried about our ability to attract applicants, period, in the near future, mostly revolving around the instability of the funding source for the department. We've seen a dramatic drop off in the volume of applications, regardless of gender or ethnicity. It's just getting tough to find people that we had wanted to hire a class, the one that's referenced in that document, for September 2004. I wanted to hire 40 people, but I couldn't find 40 people that we were happy with, so we hired 34. And we offered to have 5 city and county police officer trainees go through our class, our recruit academy down at Camp Rylea, which they did. 2 from Multnomah County, 1 from Ontario, 1 from Sherwood, and 1 from Newburgh. And those 5 police officers got 22 weeks of training they wouldn't have got anywhere else. So we just ran them through with our people, and it was a wonderful experiment. But back to the point about the 2- and 6-year plan, I'm concerned about just drawing applicants into the mix, period. And I know that this is a trend. As I meet my state counterpart, or my counterparts from other states, they're all having the same problem. It's just that I think ours is a little bit more acute because of the budget crisis that this state experienced in 2003. So that's probably my best general answer to your question. I don't know if the Colonel would like to comment beyond that.
Madam Chair, that's pretty much it in a nutshell. I mean, it's difficult to hire, to recruit effectively when you've gone through that kind of a layoff, and it's going to potentially, the demographic shifting, it's going to potentially become even more of a challenge for public safety agencies as the baby boomers go on their way, and it's just going to be, I think there's real concern that in the future there could be job shortages for essential public safety positions as that shifts. So,
what is the reading comprehension writing level of the average applicant these days?
I'm sure. I don't know if I could answer what the standard, of course, is 12th grade.
I serve on the education subcommittee in another life, so yeah. I'm trying to find out what the connections are.
I'm going to have to get you some numbers about the success rate of people passing the written exam. I don't have them off the top of my head. Yeah. That'd be the best way for me to answer your question is what percentage of people can't pass the written test.
Yes.
And I don't know that off the top of my head, but I'll get it for you. It's lower than we would all like to think.
If you can tie that information to those applicants who are coming to you from education received in Oregon, that would be most helpful.
Okay. We should be able to. Most of our applicants come from within the state. We do have a few every class that are from outside, but mostly there are people who have grown up in Oregon and they want to be state troopers.
Madam Chair, a question. Do you have a program, or do you visit high schools to recruit?
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, high schools probably not so much as a direct recruiting, but again, this is one of the things over the years that there's a real dramatic change. When I was a sergeant or a trooper on patrol, everybody did public talks. You go talk to the driver's ed class. You go talk to kids here and there. And our staffing numbers have just basically precluded us from being able to do very much of that anymore. So we do a heck of a lot less of it than we used to, and that may be part of our problem. And then we at one point had several people assigned just to the job of recruiting, going to job fairs, going to schools and other places where they could meet with prospective applicants. But then when we got into the budget crisis of 2003, of course, we cleaned out the recruiting shop long before we did the layoffs, and we've never reinstalled those people back in there. I just don't have the staff to do it. But those kinds of opportunities are wonderful if you can do it, if you can get out to those environments. It's a great place to meet these young people and get them interested in a career with the state police, but it's been tougher than we would like.
Madam Chair, if I could just add on to that, too. This last class that we hired, for example, due to the elimination of the sworn applicant processing section, is what we used to call it, we gathered people with background or expertise that we had faith in to come together to temporarily create a sworn applicant processing function and get this process started and to oversee it to be able to pull off the school and to locate applicants. But it's a very difficult way to do that when it's part-time like that, and it's not a formal process.
I'm just looking at ways to two things. I just make a comment. I somehow we have gotten moved away from visiting schools and encouraging young people to have careers, whether it's the state trooper or whether it's whatever in the state of Oregon. And I guess, you know, I'm trying to figure out some way that we don't abandon those connections, of encouraging our young people to go forth in careers like this. So,
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, one of the things that the agency has encouraged, even though it's not officially part of the job, is that
you know, our troopers are coaching softball teams, you know, scout leaders, whatever. I mean, they're involved in their communities, and that we think that's really important, so that the communities know the officers and know them beyond just somebody in a uniform. But that's probably, we do a lot more of that now than we used to, and we think it's helpful, but we could certainly do more.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One thing I think I've asked in years past, I don't know whether how relevant it is now, but we've got a certain pool of young people in Oregon that probably want to go into law enforcement, and some of them are getting support or education at community colleges and whatnot, but I would think there's probably a relatively finite pool of people that we want to recruit from. Is there much duplication between the state police and local policing agencies in terms of background checks, physicals, drug tests, that type of thing? Are we kind of tripping all over ourselves after the same people, maybe?
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, I don't think so. We don't do any of the latter of those things you mentioned, you know, the drug test and the background and all that, till way deep into the application process that we're actually getting down to the point of making them a job offer, and we put them through all of that. If we were doing that for hundreds and hundreds of people, only a portion of which we were really going to hire, I think that would fit into the scenario you described. Excuse me. So I don't think that's the case. I think we very well may be interested in hiring the same people they're interested in hiring, our local law enforcement partners, and vice versa. The job market, the cast of employers in the state that are law enforcement, we're all here, and we're all looking for those, you know, highly qualified, very, unfortunately, kind of an uncommon young person, you know, these days. You got to find somebody that can pass the background investigation, and sometimes in between high school and college, and get them, you know, to age 21. Thank you, sir. A lot of these people end up disqualifying themselves because of activities they've engaged in the meantime. And if we could, as the senator suggested, if we could sort of establish a relationship with some of these people and persuade them it might not be a good idea to disqualify themselves in between ages 18 and 21, we'd probably have more applicants. But I don't think that's the case, Representative. I appreciate the questions, but we really don't make those kinds of expenditures or investments of time until way late in our process.
Senator Warner.
There was a question that came up this morning in the other committee that I sit on, and that was on fingerprinting and, you know, when you have a new employee and whether or not there's been a duplication of effort, and mine is like in the Department of Human Services. If the person get another job reclassed up, they do another fingerprinting and we couldn't figure out why all this duplication. The question becomes also, if there has been a background check and if there's been fingerprinting in another state agency or division, would you require it all done all over again, or will you accept what is done by the other agency?
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, I think I hate to do this, but I'd probably have to qualify that answer somehow with
particularly fingerprinting, because we've said if you got one print, isn't that just the print? Now you should file it off.
This is going to sound maybe not what you want to hear, but it's the truth, so I'll just say it. And I mean, we want to make sure if you're going to come to work for this organization with the power and the authority that police officers have in our society, we darn sure want to know exactly who you are and where you've been, and if it means we fingerprint you one more time with our own people, we would. I mean, we're going to be that careful that we don't put the wrong person in this position of authority, and that's just my answer for our department. I got fingerprinted when I was 18 years old, and I haven't been fingerprinted since. So it isn't something that happens over and over in one's career.
you answer my question at the latter.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, keep in mind that even if a Department of Human Services employee, prospective employee or provider employee, is fingerprinted, they're running through the state police's process because they are the keeper of the fingerprint information.
The issue was the duplication of fingerprints. Where the person had multiply been fingerprinted.
Yes, ma'am. Yep. And I my answer was more toward the background. So.
Well, tomorrow, members and superintendent, we will get into a discussion of the Patrol Services Division. And I would like for you to think about an issue that has been raised by the co-chairs. And it's been framed in this way. They've had some discussion about the role of statewide patrol function, the statewide patrol function, and whether some or all of the functions could be transferred to the counties. And related to this, there was discussion relating to the need for state services based on geographic location. Now, again, this is an issue. These are issues and conversations that the co-chairs have had. The way that they're framing it obviously challenges the status quo. They have no agenda. They are raising the question, and they are asking the chair and this committee to raise the question or raise the issues with you as well. So that's the intent. Please give some thought to that. Please don't lose sleep over it. Come back tomorrow and talk with us about it.
Be happy to do that, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else for the good of the order? We are adjourned.
No, thanks.